For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. So we just chanted the Genjo Koan, which is the longest chant in the chant books. I'll try to make this a little shorter than I thought I might. It's on my request, because I do want to talk about Buddhist teachings on self and non-self. You might have noticed this word self came up several times in the chant. And I'm not going to go in so much into the Genjo Koan, but more into the general, Buddhist teachings on this is the core of the Buddha's teaching, and all Buddhist traditions hold our sense of separate self as being at the core of the root of suffering. So if we don't question our ideas about the self and its relation to the world, then there's very little space for growth and personal change to occur. If we're clinging to our self-image, and we do this all the time, and even within the midst of a world that's there's constant change going on, there's a lot of energy we're exerting in this effort to have some sense of solidity. And it causes a lot of suffering to ourselves and also in how we relate to the world around us. It's a little far-fetched example, maybe, but any of you are familiar with hearing Taigen talk, I thought it's still kind of an appropriate example. The energy that we use to try to define ourselves as have some clear sense of self-identity is in a little bit like the fossil fuel industries who's trying to deny climate change being caused by fossil fuels. There's a lot of money and efforts that's been going on to deny that this change is happening or that it's being caused the way that the science pretty clearly indicates that it does. So I just thought it was an appropriate, again, a little far-fetched example, but it just shows that there's a lot of effort to maintain the status quo when that's not actually in line with reality, and there's a lot of suffering that comes out of that, and yet it's possible. It's not really possible to defy reality, but it's very possible to influence how we perceive it. Similarly, in the midst of a world of change that we're living in, we do exert a lot of energy. Our minds try very hard behind the scenes to maintain some coherent understanding and sense of self. And this hinders not only does it cause suffering, but it also hinders any sort of alternative approaches to might take to our lives. So, as understanding change is at the core of Buddhist insight, I want to explore this sort of self-clinging, mostly through a temporal perspective, the teachings of impermanence. It's taught that if we can see impermanence, we can see these other two characteristics of all conditioned phenomena, which is the clinging to them causes suffering, and that the no-self aspect, that it's not separate from the world around it. So as we chanted in the Genjo Koan, Dogen says... in the fascicle, when you ride in a boat and watch the shore, you might assume that the shore is moving. But when you keep your eyes closely on the boat, you can see that the boat moves. Similarly, if you examine myriad things with a confused body and mind, you might suppose that your mind and nature are permanent. When you practice intimately and return to where you are, it will be clear that nothing at all has unchanging self. So this imagery of the boat and the shore, I'm sure you've experienced some version of it. It speaks to me as I get the memories of being a little kid and riding the train down to my grandparents in Sweden, which is usually when we take the train, and sitting on the train at the station and seeing another train through the window, and then seeing that train moving all of a sudden and not being sure which, realizing that it's actually our train that's moving. It just started rolling really smoothly. So what Dogen is saying is, you know, similarly, you might think that what we're perceiving is what's changing here, but if we're studying ourself, if we're keeping the eyes closely on the boat, we will see that the self is constantly changing. And of course, the example is limited in the way, because he then, you know, says later that it will be clear that nothing at all has unchanging self. So not only are we changing, but everything around us too. So when the Buddha would receive questions, just like what is a person, or what is human experience, what is happening, he would answer with his model of the five skandhas. That's the Sanskrit term we usually translate as aggregates or heaps or streams sometimes. There's these five different aspects of describing, you know, that sort of encompasses our experiences of the world. So it's form, which it's our body, or how we define it, which is actually more materiality, because we define what we see as our body or me, physical me, in relation to what is also conceived as not me. Right? And then feelings are these core, just basic emotions of positive, negative, or neutral initial impulses, you know. There's perception, which is our capacity for sort of pulling out certain characteristics of something and calling this a table and this paper. You know, there's certain discrimination that we make in order to conceive of reality in such a way. Mental formations, which is sort of where our present experience hooks into something in the past, and it can lead to all sorts of karmic formations there. This is a skanda we're, I think, closely connected to our karmic conditionings, and our intentions depends on how we've been conditioned in the past. And then consciousness, which is our sort of self-awareness and sort of splitting the world up into object, self, subject and object, and different objects from each other too. Anyway, not to go into the technicalities of those so much, it's more the reason for the model is more to explain that if we're thinking that there's some part of me that's some essence that endures over time, changeless, as I go about my life, the Buddha was using this model and saying that, seeing that all these five aspects of ourself is constantly changing, and there's not, our experience can't touch anything that does not change over time. It could all be, any experience can be, you know, categorized into one of these, any particular feelings, or, you know, sights and sounds, ideas, you know, desire, whatever is arising, it can be categorized under one of these five skandhas. And apart from them, there's actually no I, no unchanging self to be found. So as I was considering these, it struck me, there's one interesting aspect is how these five aspects of the Buddha, one of them is physical and four is mental, and that he didn't break down the physical form further, because if we're studying the self, if we're considering our own physical self, it's pretty clear if we're looking at it over time that there's been change and there is change going on. This is a different body than the one that my mother gave birth to 38 years ago, and it's a different body whose heart will beat its last beat sometime later in the future. So it's not so hard to see that there isn't anything unchanging if we're thinking about our bodies. I was thinking about it as like maybe our teeth are once, you know, developed in our teeth, they're kind of the least changing, but we're, you know, putting effort every day into making them stay the way they are, actually. So I think you can find the self in the teeth and neither in any other part of our body. That seems pretty clear, but it's a lot less clear if we're thinking about just our mental aspects of ourselves, and just if we're thinking of it as something uniform. We can see how we have different ideas and thoughts and, you know, all these things, but we kind of need to break it down a little further to see that there's nothing behind there that isn't changing. I think that's why the Buddha broke, you know, the mental aspect down in these four different skandhas. It's also considering how we might react if our sense of self is being threatened. And if it's if we're feeling physically threatened, then it's, you know, probably react with the fight or flight response, unless we've got some martial arts or other, you know, non-violence training that we can apply to do something that's neither harming the other nor, you know, exerting danger to ourselves. It's probably one of the two. But if we're sort of identification on a mental level is that, then the might we respond if somebody says something to us that challenges our sense of self, our identity? Let's say they some blame is put onto us that affects us. We feel accused. There's some on some level there's some threat to our sense of self. I think if there isn't, probably won't take it so personally, but if we do, there's some something a little threatening going on there. And I think there's two different approaches there. The common one, that there's always some little it's always going on some little level as a kind of repression on some way, where we are filtering our experiences, and the ones that fit into our sense of self is, are let in, and we're filtering the other ones out somehow. And this goes on even on a sort of little bit of a level, because if the Buddhist teachings are true, that we actually aren't separate, there are sense impressions there that are being filtered through our thinking mind to prevent us from seeing that. But you know, that's a small level of I don't know. It's calling it repression. But if we're more directly threatened, like somebody blaming us or you know accusing us or something, and we can feel that we're stirred up, then the way we tend to try to deal with that is to sort of recontextualize our story of self. So a certain mental state in the present will spread into we're telling ourselves there's some little storytelling going on, and it's so subtle that we don't usually see it as that. But so if somebody's saying, oh, you're never showing up, you're failing me again, whatever, something like that, then, and I take that to heart, I'm much more likely to go into telling a story of, oh yeah, and remembering all those times in the past when I failed, and think about the future and how the way I've been thinking my life is going to go isn't going to work that way either. And then we're in a much more joyous and buoyant state. We have a much more positive outlook on our past and our future. So there's this little recontextualizing and sort of rewriting our story constantly, and then believing that this is the way it's always been, that helps us to maintain a sense of coherency that's important for us, or sense of stability and resisting change. And often it's not just ourselves we're telling these stories, but we often tell them to others too. And if we can make other people believe that this is really who we are, then it makes it easy for us to believe that as too. One personal example I was thinking of this is years ago. It's before, just the year before I first went to practice residentially at Green Gulch. I was in spent most of the year in India and Thailand. I was doing some voluntary work and some retreats, and I'd been away for quite a while. I'd spent 6 months in India, and then I was I'd been in Thailand for a couple of months, and traveling and meeting people from all over the world, all the time, and sharing stories. And I was having was sitting down for lunch by myself in this restaurant, and this Canadian woman came and sat down opposite to me, and we started talking. And I found her difficult. There was something almost for me a little aggressive in her behavior. And I excused myself once I had finished my meal and left, because she was very dominant in the conversation. But as I reflected on it afterwards, I realized that what was bothering me was that I had this story that I was telling everybody that I was meeting of what I'd been doing and where I was going, the volunteer work I've been doing and the retreats. And then I was applying to this is just the year after the tsunami, and I was applying to go and help farmers who lost their lands in the tsunami in Indonesia, help to relocate them and get them going in the little organic cooperatives and counter the sort of industrial ag funding to get them on large scale, getting hooked on chemical agriculture. Anyway, I realized as I was reflecting on it afterwards that she hadn't given me a sense to tell my story, and that was what it was upsetting to me, that I was just needing to be listen to her story. And I think there was something there as I was moving around and not having so much of a in our everyday life, we have a job, a place to live, and there's there's these various aspects of our everyday life that we can sort of hang up our story of self on. And as I was traveling, there was a lot less of that, but there was therefore a lot more need to continuously be telling stories about who I was to others to make myself believe that too. And this woman actually did me a favor by challenging me, because the story became a lot less attractive. I could see how afterwards how it was just a story I was telling. I was also thinking of Facebook, for those who are on Facebook, that this might be another opportunity to see as you're posting something. We're talking about a Thursday night group not so long ago. It's like, are you wanting to share with your contacts, or you know, what's going on, or is it more like wanting to be perceived a certain way, you know, sort of putting a mask on in some way? So it could be a practice opportunity to consider as well. So our practice of Zazen, I think, helps us with both to sort of counter both of these aspects of maintaining a sense of solid, enduring self, both the sort of little, you know, repressive or selective, managing of which experiences we bring into our consciousness, and also to study our storytelling. Uchiyama Roshi, it's the book title, and speaks about Zazen as opening the hand of thought. So that when we sit down, we can let our thinking mind go, and our, you know, where we usually tending to grasp onto things, and there's always self in there to just relax and let that go, and it's the possibility of sitting in this calm, quiet space of seeing new things and seeing things differently. And Suzuki Roshi similarly talked about beginner's mind. And he also likened our practice of Zazen and ourself to swinging doors that moves when we inhale and when we exhale. Sort of the illustration of this fluidity and change. And Zazen also allows us to study our mind's tendency to write these stories about ourselves, and you know, you see how much story and you know, and see where it's like there's a self in there. It seems to be like it's just thinking, but there's some self in there. If we look closely enough, there's some need to be somebody. So we can contemplate the self also by observing how these stories change over time. You know, as I said before, you know, it's hard to see them as stories because they blend in with our present emotional state. But if we look at it over time, we can see how the story, how we're perceiving ourselves in our past and future, changes over time. Yeah, if we've been feeling some specific way, you know, then just ask yourself lately, is that still true? You know, or journaling can be a good practice, you know. Who's kept journals over some time can see how what seems so real and true about ourselves at one point is does not, you know, the next day maybe, or maybe a little longer, but certainly changes. And good friends, you know, often can sort of question us on, that's not what you were saying before, it sounds a lot different. So we can do this for each other too, if we're skillful. So I think the last thing, I'm running out of time, I wanted to say also is that our forms can be an opportunity to study ourselves. And change, you know, strictly speaking, you know, if the world, you know, if nothing at all has unchanging self, if everything is truly changing all the time, then we can't actually be doing the same thing twice, and it's not the same person doing the same thing as last week. But relatively speaking, you know, most of our movements in this room are highly scripted. You know, we put our palms together, you know, just in line with the nose, you know, fits with away from the nose, and elbows out, and bow from the hips when we come in, and then we go to our seat. We hold our hands this way, we bow to our seat, turn around clockwise, and we bow around, and we sit down, and we turn around, and, you know, keep our spine upright and chin tucked, and hands, you know, left palm and right palm, and thumb tips gently touching, and we do these things every time, and it can allow us some to actually see something strange. You know, maybe one day you're bowing and it's like this is joy and enthusiasm in it, and the next time you're coming there's some little resistance to fully doing the forms, and really you just want to like you know. So by repeating something over and over again, we can see we can actually get in touch with how we're what our present state is, and see how it's a different experience than it was last time we did it. So again, this is we can do this when we brush our teeth and or wait for the bus on our way to work too. It doesn't have to be in here certainly. But it's something with the scripting of it that helps us, I think, because when we experience something new, when we're thinking that we experience something new, we're usually so drawn to the object that we forget to, as Dogen says, you know, keep our eyes closely on the boat. So I think that's what I want to say. Let's finish with one of the few more sentences from the Genjo Koan, where Dogen says, this is some of the most famous lines in Dogen's writing. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments or reflections? Or Yoshi? It sounds a little like what my experience was in Thailand. There was some grasping for a story. I heard too that somebody said when the Soviet Union fell, the infrastructure in the country was such that even though the whole economy collapsed, there wasn't really a threat of surviving, you know, not surviving, that people had, you know, the social networks and other things to take care of each other. But there was like the amount of people dying in alcoholism just shot way up, and this person was saying that that had a lot to do with their worldview, which is, you know, very tied into our sense of self collapsing, and not, you know, this being this vacuum there, like what you've been so indoctrinated with believing in falling away, and there's nothing sort of to replace it. It's indirectly ties into our sense of self. Yeah, Ken.
The and now the phrase to know the self is to forgive the self.
Yeah.
And what sometimes comes to my mind is, let's say somebody has a personal mission. You know, they're going to be a doctor, or they're going to be an Albert Schweitzer, or they're going to be a missionary, something in that order. So they're completely devoted to that mission, or military mission. You know, I was very impressed about the similarity between some of the military virtues and some of the Buddhist practices. The practice comes first, and your injury and whatever else you might suffer, or whatever you have to go through, is secondary, you know. And but that's really not the same as what's being talked about in Genjo Koan, which is to forget the self is to be actualized by all things. Right, but that's, if you could elaborate on that, the difference between that Buddhist notion and the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Where somebody can forget themselves in their mission or their personal commitment.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I think one of them is like, you know, the Buddhist practice is, you know, if we're looking closely, we, you know, we see that this, you know, self actually cannot be found. There's some, hopefully by studying, there's some flexibility in coming in and not identifying as one thing. You know, we can be totally open to being one person in one setting and a different one in a different. It's not like we don't have no self, but there's no holding, you know, on. And I think what you're talking about sounds, you know, yeah, we're forgetting ourselves, but there's a strong identity with being in a certain group. I know a friend of mine was talking about going to, he's British, but going to soccer games in England, and you know, the sort of the group, the supporter thing, where you can really forget yourself in the group, but there is this strong identity of us and us versus them. And I think that's similar to the military thing, where you're joining into something bigger, but it's still, what defines you is very much being against something, right?
Right. And the Buddhist practice, there is no specific identity to be attached to.
Yeah.
Right.
And in opposition to, yeah. Brian,
you were talking about the stillness, and I was thinking about a quote I read a while ago, where someone was saying that what we do with what we call the self is to mistake what is a cluster of processes for a thing.
Yeah.
And in thinking about that cluster of processes, which this person was referring to, the skandhas that way, the skandhas are all activities, aren't they? I mean, there's things that you do,
they're
actions, are they not?
Well, I don't know, there's activity going on, and there's like this tonight, there's change there, yeah.
In each of them, there's a sense.
Yeah.
It's not,
I mean, it's active.
This has a certain quality to its, you know, physical makeup or something. It's perception and formation and different.
Yeah.
Which is really, to me, the reason I'm asking that is that it seems as if what we call the self is a cluster of activities.
Yeah. Yeah, well, quoting a book title of a book I haven't read. I have read Opening the Hand of Thought, but it's Mark Epstein, Thoughts Without a Thinker, yeah. You know, as being the sort of Buddhist way, you know, just because there's activity doesn't mean that there's an actor.
Right.
Yeah. Or, you know, in the sense, to the extent that there is an actor, it's totally not separate from this act of, you know, can't be defined outside of what its action is. Oh, Matt, last question. Yeah. Matt heard me give a similar talk at Rockefeller. I tried to change it a little bit for his benefit. Thank you. I said how when I was ordained, I took the name Hakusho. I was Johann. That's the name my parents gave me when I was born. And I took my Dharma name as partly based on an experience I had earlier when I got a nickname and at work, and that really changed my. There was a different. As I started to identify with that, there was a different sense of self while I was at work, wearing the name Joe, and then when I went home and saw my friends, it was Johann. And so, taking my Dharma name was an opportunity to, for sort of a new self, a fresh self, to arise that wasn't so. Tied into my past, because I think there is a lot of just when we hear our name, there's, you know, it's like, this is me. So there was something else that was triggered. The other part was that people, I think, related to me differently. When I met people and I gave them a Swedish name, the conversation would go into the fact that I was Swedish, and when I would present myself as Hakusho, we talk about me being a priest, so there's a different sense of self that comes from that too. And having been a priest for 4 years now, I, you know, there's like, it's quite an identity that's built around Hakusho too, so can't escape. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.